Hello and welcome to another episode of Lost in Science. You're with Lyndon today. And this week we're bringing you another of our summer series where we look back at some of the great conversations that we had in 2025. Today I'm bringing you two chats that I had with people who have made it their life mission to look after nature. Our first interview this morning will be with Professor Ewan Ritchie, who's a professor of ecology at Deakin University, talking about the claimed resurrection of the dire wolf earlier in 2025. So it's a really, I think it's a thoughtful conversation around the benefits as well as the risks of saying that the dire wolf has been brought back from extinction. Professor Ritchie talks a lot about how that's not actually the case, but the potential benefits of this kind of technology when it comes to conservation. And then we're going to chat to Clancy Lester. Clancy is a bug scientist, an insect scientist, and he has a very strong and active social media presence that has become really impactful when it comes to looking after urban environments, looking after bugs and bees and insects, and all of the incredible work that they do to keep our planet running. So Clancy talks about what he's passionate about, an incredible expedition that he took in 2025 to the Amazon to check out some of the coolest bugs in the world, and also some of the bugs and the insects that he thinks really rock in Australia. Two excellent conversations. I look forward to sharing them with you. Stay tuned.
What are you onto? Anything of interest to the scientific community?
Together, you and I are going to make the greatest single contribution to science since the creation of fire!
It's a big scientific experiment. What do I know?
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
We are thrilled to be joined now by Ewan Ritchie. Ewan is a professor of wildlife ecology and conservation at Deakin University. Ewan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Lyndon.
I've been wanting to get you on the show for a little while, and when this news came out, this big splash in the media around dire wolves, those famous white wolves from Game of Thrones have been brought back from extinction, my eyebrows were raised. And then I thought, right, I need to talk to somebody who knows a bit more about this than I do, which is why we've got you here. Please, can you explain like what this means? Has something really been brought back from extinction?
First of all, dire wolves in the true sense have definitely not been brought back. And I think that's what upset a lot of people in the scientific community. We can argue about what a dire wolf actually is, but a true dire wolf has not been brought back. And they obviously went extinct a long time ago, many thousands of years ago. I think it's about 13,000 years ago, I think, was the last time dire wolves were recorded. And they were obviously spanning the North American continent as well as actually down into South America too, for about 200,000 years, roughly. They no longer exist. They were about, I think about 25% or more larger than a grey wolf. But I guess there would have been overlap in some of the larger grey wolves and dire wolves in terms of their body size. The main difference between grey wolves and dire wolves is that dire wolves had much stronger jaws, much more powerful jaws to allow them to kill and consume very large prey. And obviously we know that thousands of years ago, right around the world, there was large numbers of megafauna. They still exist in some places like Africa, but in many other continents, those megafauna are now extinct. And the dire wolf, of course, is also extinct. And so my understanding, and I'm not a geneticist, so I wanted to say that straight off the top of the bat, is that basically what's happened is that they have modified some segments of the grey wolf genome, and then they have raised embryos in a surrogate host and have produced animals that have some genetic modifications that are dire wolf-like in grey wolves. So I think a key misunderstanding often in this de-extinction topic is that people talk about cloning, and you can only clone an animal from living tissue. So people might remember Dolly the sheep. That was a clone. So you can only bring back a clone from living tissue. Of course, we don't have any living direwolves anymore, like we don't have any living thylacines, so they won't be clones either. They will be a genetically modified fat-tailed Dunart that becomes thylacine-like. How like it is a thylacine, of course, is up for debate. And there's the genetic side of it, of course, the genetic arguments, and then there's how does it behave? What's its ecology look like? So, this direwolf inverted commas achievement is a scientific achievement. There's no question about that. There's still some fantastic science behind it, but it's fair to say that it has frustrated a lot of people for a whole range of reasons. And I personally would say that direwolves have not been brought back yet.
It's helpful to think about it, I guess, rather than as bringing a direwolf back. It's what Colossal have produced is a genetically modified grey wolf. Perhaps they've changed, what is it, 20 of the
That was my
tens of thousands
understanding.
of genes?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, so a small amount of genetic information, relatively speaking, has been changed. And of course, we all know that it's complicated with animals because genes often don't operate in isolation. Understanding how all genes operate together, etc., all of those things are quite difficult to do. And I'm not questioning, of course, that they don't have a good understanding of this. I guess another tricky part is that this research is not published. So we don't actually have a peer-reviewed publication to see exactly what they've done. So we're essentially sort of seeing what they've told us, but we don't actually have a peer-reviewed publication yet. And I think that's a really important thing for people to bear in mind too, that we might put different weight depending on whether something is a work in progress versus a published article. I think they carry different scientific weight. So yeah, it's definitely not a true direwolf. It is a genetically modified grey wolf, as many people have pointed out, and many people who are far more expert in genetics than I am.
Well, you are an expert in conservation, though, and ecology, and I want to pick up that point you said around direwolves is not just genetic, it's not just their genetics, right? It's how they live in their environment, which of course, as you say, sort of doesn't exist anymore. And the same would be true of other de-extinction activities, bringing back the thylacine, which is a big project here in Australia. I've also heard that the Colossal organization's been looking at bringing back the dodo. You know, these species that don't exist. It's interesting to think about how they would learn to exist if they had no parents to teach them. From your point of view, as a conservationist, where do you see the role of these de-extinction activities? Do you think they have their place in conservation? Or, you know, I've read lots of articles that have said, no, we should be spending this money on protecting the animals that we do have already. Do you think there's a role for this, or is it a bit too splashy to be real? Too Jurassic Park to be helpful?
Look, there's a whole range of different arguments that I think need to be discussed. First of all, in terms of the finances, I think that could be put to bed pretty easily. So people will say, if we fund research into the thylacine and try and de-extinct the thylacine, that is somehow compromising conservation because it means money is not available for something else. That assumes that it's a zero-sum game, right? It assumes that that amount of money is finite, and by spending that up, we can't spend it on conserving something else. That's just simply not true, right? There's huge amounts of money in the world, and we choose to spend that money in a whole range of ways. Ideally, we would spend a whole lot more money on conservation, and we have the capacity to do so. Many governments around the world have the capacity to do so. The Australian government chooses not to do so. They can explain why that is the case. So that argument that money for thylacines is taking money away from something else just doesn't hold. And the fact of the matter is that, companies like Colossal that are being funded by, very wealthy philanthropists, they are passionate about this topic. There's no guarantee that if they didn't spend money on trying to bring back these species, they'd spend it on something else. They may not. So, that's their personal choice. So I don't have a problem with that. I think the question about should we bring them back is a really important one, because of course in some cases the question is their environment even going to be there for them? The woolly mammoth being, I think, the classic example of that. The woolly mammoth, of course, lived in areas like the tundra, which very well is disappearing because of climate change. So I think there's a real ethical challenge there, aside from the can you actually bring this back, the genetic scientific challenge of that. Even if you can bring it back, is there going to be suitable habitat for that species? And if there's not, Where does it live? You know, and then so there's a big moral and ethical question around if you can even bring them back, can you provide something that's even, remotely similar to where it once lived? And if you can't, is that an acceptable thing to do? And that then does get you, like you say, into the Jurassic Park kind of territory. Are these things just going to be novelties somewhere where people can go and see them? And is that an acceptable thing to do? That's a moral and ethical question, which again, I'm not really qualified to necessarily give a good answer to, but I think it's something that we should definitely think about. I think we should, as scientists, always be trying different things, and we learn by doing that. You know, I'm sure when people said, we're going to go to space, people would have said, it's impossible. You can't do it. Like, you're mad, right? And of course, people did end up going into space. And so scientists should be taking big challenges. Of course, we should always be thinking of the ethics and the morals around those decisions. But why not, do those challenges? And I think, as Professor Andy Pask and others have said, this is not just about bringing back the thylacine or other species. Along the way, they are learning things about, genetics and approaches to manipulating the genetics of species. And in some cases, that will have potential real-world benefits for living species. So, as an example, we could modify the genetic code of northern quolls or species of goannas, which eat cane toads. And when they do that, currently they die because it's toxic. You can modify their genetics in some cases, we believe, to the point that the cane toad would no longer be toxic. It'd be a tasty snack that they could eat, at nauseam. And that, of course, would be good for the wildlife because they're no longer dying, the native wildlife, but also potentially help to control numbers of cane toads. So I think, we need to be really careful when we see controversial ideas, not to, as I say, eat our own. Like, I think there's this tendency with some people to stomp on others and tread on others because they're doing something really, really ambitious. And yes, sometimes they may communicate it in a way that is not entirely accurate. But I think we should always still have an eye on the big picture about some of the benefits as well. So I think we need to weigh those things up. And I've been a little bit disappointed, I'd have to say, with some of the commentary I've seen around the direwolves and around thylacines too, that a lot of people have been, I would say, overly harsh about the projects. I'm not saying for a second that in some cases they could have been communicated, I think, more honestly and clearly. But I think we can go too far the other way sometimes. And we need to be thinking about different approaches to conservation because the fact of the matter is we have huge challenges around the world with conserving biodiversity, and we need to have all options on the table.
Yeah, it's definitely. I like your idea around thinking we were so excited about the idea about whether we could do something. We didn't stop to think about whether we should, particularly given the environments that are no longer present for many of these species that are of interest for de-extincting, which we know is not really the accurate word. But one last question for you before I let you go, Ewan, is given your extensive public communication. I know you do so many radio interviews, TV interviews, articles, lots of different things. And as you just said, there is space for a lot of miscommunication in this nuanced environment. There's a lot of experts in different fields jumping on this work as being excellent or being awful, or, there's lots of black and white where surely there should be shades of grey. But what do you think about this kind of research in terms of inspiring the next generation of scientists? Where do you think this sits?
Look, I mean, I think there's no question it gets people excited. I mean, the fact of the matter is there was a dire wolf, inverted commas, on the cover of Time magazine. How often do you see biodiversity featured in platforms like that? Not very often. So I think, again, we have to think carefully about the balance between, accuracy, and that's a really important part of science still. But we do need to motivate people to get them interested in science and to also think about solutions that we have to big challenges. Like I said, I think we always still have to emphasize the many challenges along that whole pathway in case of de-extinction. So the genetics, as I've said, is just part of it. You mentioned before, will they actually behave like, these animals? That is a big question for me as an ecologist. We have no idea how these things were supposed to behave because they're dead and they've been dead for a long time and they have literally nothing to learn from. So In the case of things like dire wolves, which presumably were highly social species, because analogues like grey wolves definitely are, how will they behave? And I think another really interesting challenge too that no one I can think of has mentioned is, should you bring these animals back and release them into the wild? There is very serious concern from my behalf about their safety, because trophy hunting for large animals is a big problem around the world. And can you imagine how many hunters would love to say that they were the first person to hunt and kill a dire wolf? There
Geez, yeah.
will be people that will say that. And the same could be said about the Thylacine. So there is big questions around, is the habitat there? Will they behave even like this putative animal that we're trying to bring back? And then can you guarantee their safety? So I think, we just need to be really open and transparent about all of those things. But I do still want people to really support, science that's pushing the boundaries, because as long as it's done in an ethical way and people can debate whether it's ethical or not, we can learn a lot. And we've seen that right across all sorts of different scientific fields. And so, I would say, and I know you would say the same thing, that there is a huge role here for really clear and effective science communication alongside the cool science.
Totally agree. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, Ewan. I know that you come at this from a caring for the whole planet point of view. So we really appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lyndon.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Lost in Science, and today I have with me the man himself, the B-man, Clancy Lester. How are you, Clancy? Nice to have you on the show.
I'm great, Lennon.
You're a force. You're a force of nature. I'm not going to lie. It's a great privilege to have you on the show, but I'm interested to hear how you got to where you are. What made you decide, this is what I'm going to do?
It's probably couldn't be broken up into more than just the one main thing. I think it started off with the fact that nobody knew about, or nobody knows about, how insects are declining. And that was one thing when I started learning about through my research up in Northeast Arnhem Land with the Yolngu people, that nobody in the general public even knows native bees exist, or that insects are declining around the world. Like, one thing I say to get people to realise that is, when's the last time you cleaned bugs off your windscreen? But we used to do that all the time if we went on a road trip, and nobody seems to do that anymore. And then I think just probably the other thing has just been the support. When I sort of started out and I was like so little and just reaching a few people, but those few people were so encouraging, and that really made me want to, invest my time and energy into really advocating and investing in it and reaching for the sky.
How do you go about advocating for the bees?
Oh, there's a whole heap range of different things. So there's things like when people want to sign petitions to get, remnant habitat protected from housing development, and trying to get people involved in stopping that from happening, or trying to get people to encourage native wildlife in their local backyard or local parks and reserves by planting native plants, and all these sorts of little things that do seem to add up when a whole bunch of people are doing it as a collective.
But you're also doing work on your own, right? You build bee hotels that you sell to people, and you also run workshops. Is that right? What sort of audiences are you reaching with the workshops that you run?
Well, those audiences of the workshops start at about 2 or 3 years old.
Oh, I've
even been to early learning centres, because kids can still get their hands dirty and mix clay and sand together for the ground nesting bees, or they can put cut up bits of bamboo in tin cans. So up from 2 or 3 up to, I think the oldest I reckon I've had is maybe about mid-80s. I've had at some oldies at gardening clubs. So I have a very wide range of people that show up for native bees and want to get involved.
You mentioned ground dwelling bees or ground nesting bees. I didn't realise that they existed. Where do they live?
Yeah,
apart from in the ground.
Yeah. So the blue banner bee, which is, when I say, do you know if native bees exists? The very few people that do know of native bees have heard of the blue banner bee, and that is a ground nesting bee. So they will dig their nest down into clay and sandy soils or along riverbanks where there's a bit of a cliff face, and that's why sometimes you'll get them in the mortar in between your bricks in a mud brick house. Mm-hmm. About 70% of our 2,000 species of native bees will nest in the ground.
Wow, that's amazing. Wait, how many species of native bees did you say we had?
I said we had over 2,000 species. So the currently accepted number is 1,717 officially described species, but we have some sitting in museum drawers, some that have been collected and haven't even been sent in yet, and we've still got some to find. So they said at least 2,000 when we get them all.
Sounds like a much more fun version of Pokemon Go when we get them all. Do you think that's possible? Do you think we'll be able to identify all the native bees?
Australia's a very big place, and we've got some pretty remote areas where the bees would still exist. Even in the middle of the harshest deserts, there's still some bees that are hanging around.
This is maybe an offensive question, and I apologise if I offend you, but I mean, what do native bees offer that the standard bee that we see around, not the blue-banded bee, but your standard bee, what do native bees offer that this, I assume that's an introduced bee,
yep,
European bee, what do our native bees do that European introduced bees do not?
So the European bee's a great pollinator, and it'll pollinate a lot of exotic plants and a lot of native plants, but it is limited into what some of the specialist relationships, which Australia, as such an isolated continent for millions of years, we've had such a lengthy period of time where native wasps and native flies and native bees have developed these specialist relationships between the native plants that they pollinate. And so you see these intricate structures, which, like, there's this native moth that pollinates Baronias that has this little pollen collecting structure on its abdomen, or you have native bees which are capable of buzz pollinating, which European honeybees can't do, where they'll literally shake the flower by vibrating their wings for flight, but they don't actually flap their wings, their body just shakes, and they'll release the pollen from buzz pollinated plants.
Wow.
And so there's so many of these really amazing specialist relationships which are not replaceable by a European honeybee.
So then what role do the bee hotels in particular have then? Is that one of the main sources of stress for many of these species, that they don't have anywhere to live?
Yeah, in an urban environment, because when you think about, say, like a park or garden near your home, you think some of the places where native bees love to nest in, like in the natural environment, they love to nest in bare, open clay or sandy soils, and they love to nest in the holes in wood boring holes from grubs in dead tree stumps or dead logs, or they love to nest in the hollows from, say, like the cuttings of old dead flowers that are hollow or pithy stemmed, the bamboo or reeds and things which have died. And so if you think about your local park, the second there's a tree branch that falls over, gets taken away and cleared off, all of the bare open ground is covered by mulch. So a lot of the natural nesting sites for native bees don't really exist in an urban environment. And so we can provide supplementary habitat with these bee hotels.
You said that when you first started out, sort of process after you finished your training, you have a master's in, what's it called, entomology?
It had a bit of everything. I can't really call myself an entomologist because there's some bee nerds and bug nerds that would just out nerd me. So can't really quite claim that, I reckon.
Okay, I'm not gonna ask you to reel off a bunch of scientific names here. But you said you had a lot of support when you first started. Does that extend to local councils and local community groups that could possibly reverse some of these decisions that are made about cleaning up potential bee habitats and insect habitats?
Yeah, and this is one thing which I've really enjoyed about having my platform, is when I've seen like local councils that have had petitions, or they've had people ask things at question time during council meetings, or they've launched campaigns towards getting approval for things like planting native plants and flowers in their nature strips instead of the standard grass, which is a monoculture and not supportive of any biodiversity. And so there's been these things that have gone through councils that have actually changed through like community engagement and community advocation.
Wow. And you went to Parliament not that long ago as well.
Yeah, I've been to Parliament as an ABC trailblazer. So that was for initiatives run by youth in regional and rural communities. And so I got a lot of support from the ABC for marketing and online reach and social media, which was really handy. And also getting the chance to talk to politicians and put it in the back of their mind what they should be really looking after.
It's wonderful to have people going to that grass-covered hill. Did you start a bit of a petition to replace that with some native plants?
Yeah, I definitely did. We filmed a video with ABC News sitting on the front lawn of Parliament and talking about how it would look much better with natives. Yeah,
I think
that one has like over 500,000 views on that.
Wow.
Yeah, so a few people were agreeing.
You have gone further afield as well, right, than Parliament House. You recently came back from South America.
Yep, I wanted to go to South America. It's always a dream of mine. I grew up a David Attenborough, Steve Irwin, obsessed kid, loved watching National Geographic. And the Amazon is one of those places that just holds such an amazing array of biodiversity, particularly insects in some of the parts. And I just wanted to go over there and find as many cool bugs as I could. And cool bugs I found.
How do they compare to the native insects?
I think it's hard to compare any of the native bees we have here with the orchid bees in South America. They're called orchid bees because the male wants to smell as good as possible for the ladies. So they go to orchids and collect the perfumes and try and smell as good as they can. And they are just the most shiny metallic greens and blues and pink colours you've ever seen. It's just amazing.
Apart from the orchid bee, what would you say, we must get this question all the time, particularly from the 2 and 3 year olds, what's your favourite Australian insect?
Oh, wow. I think that definitely up there would be the cuckoo bee.
What's a cuckoo bee?
So that's similar to the cuckoo bird. Mm-hmm. It's a parasitic animal. So it's a kleptoparasite or a pollen stealer. And everything about its evolution is designed to parasitizing the blue-banded bee. So it has so many cool adaptations. So it has similar colours so it can sneak in the nest undetected, and it has overdeveloped mandibles of the larvae when it's only just a grub so that they're capable of killing the blue-banded bee baby if the blue-banded bee egg hatches. And everything about them is just designed to parasitize the blue-banded bee. Yeah, and they're also just incredible bright blue neon colours as well. They're definitely one of my favourites.
Oh, okay.
But that's such a hard question to answer because about a million things come to my mind though.
Where can you find the cuckoo bee?
Wherever you can find the blue-banded bee. So in most parts of Australia apart from Tasmania.
And the blue-banded bee, what time of year is the best time to look for the blue-banded bee?
Probably towards the end of spring and into the summertime. There and then through to early autumn.
Most insects are active in the warmer months. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, quite a few, particularly native bees. A lot of our native bees won't see them flying around in the winter time, and that's because throughout the winter time they often exist in their life cycles as grubs and pupae.
If people want to find out more about you, book a workshop or order a bee hotel, where can they find you, Clancy?
So I'm on social media at beesandblossoms.oz, and that's where you can find me. And I also have a website, nativebeehotels.com. So if you want to learn any cool facts about bees or see some cool bugs and the videos I make about Indigenous knowledge and that sort of thing, feel free to follow along or learn how to build a bee hotel as well.
Beesandblossoms.oz. Thanks for joining us, Clancy, on Lost in Science.
Thanks for having me on, Lyndon.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.